friends and colleagues, and welcome to Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. This is a bonus episode. Dermasphere is, as of today, when I'm recording this, June 17th, 2020, 1 year old. Because we released our first episode on June 17th, 2019. But that episode wasn't the only episode we recorded, obviously, or we wouldn't have been going for a year, nor was it the first episode we recorded. When we were learning how to make a podcast, the sources that we read suggested that you record a few episodes for practice. And the podcast industry referred to these as demo episodes, and so we call them demo episodes, even though we weren't really demoing them for anybody except ourselves and some of our friends and colleagues who listened to them to give us some feedback. So we recorded three of those, and they're a bit raw, but I think there's still some valuable information in them, and some of my favorite articles that we have reviewed have actually been in those demo episodes. They have been available. They are on our website, dermaspherepodcast.com, but it might be kind of hard to find them, especially if you just listen to this on Apple iTunes or whatever. So we thought we'd release them as bonus episodes, in part as a celebration of Dermasphere's one-year birthday. Look at that cute little baby Dermasphere, just starting to walk. Anyway, I'm planning to release these sort of every other week in between our normal shows, so over the next two-ish months, all three of them should be released. I'm planning to go in reverse order, so the first thing we'll do today is demo episode number 3, and if you really get hooked, demo episodes 1 and 2 are available on our website, dermaspherepodcast.com, or you can just wait around until they come out as their own bonus episodes. Thanks a lot! Welcome to Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists for dermatologists and the dermatologically curious, where we do our best to keep you up to date on the latest developments in our field, all the things that are out there in the dermosphere. I am Luke Johnson, associate assistant professor, that's what I am still, of dermatology at the University of Utah. I do general dermatology and I have special training in pediatric dermatology. And with me, of course,
I'm Michelle Tarbox. I'm an assistant professor of dermatology and dermatopathology, as well as a self-proclaimed dermoscopy nerd at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Thanks a lot for joining us today. We're going to jump into our articles. Michelle, I think you've got the first one.
I do. I have a great article that it's a subject I really enjoy talking about, which is dermoscopy. This is specifically covering a single center study evaluating the clinical and dermoscopic features of longitudinal melanonychia, along with evaluating the ABCDEF criteria, which are a modified criteria used for nail unit pigmented lesions, and the risk of malignancy. And this is an article that was published in the JAD in 2018. The reason this is important is that subungual melanomas, while they are rare, accounting for only up to 3.5% of melanomas worldwide, have very high stakes because they're usually caught late due to our general reluctance to puncture the nail unit and potentially cause deformity later on. So they're diagnosed late and they tend to have a relatively poor prognosis because of their average Breslow depth usually ranging between 3.5 and 4.7 millimeters at diagnosis, which portends a poor survival rate somewhere between a 5-year survival rate of 30% and a 10-year survival rate of 13%. So this article, among some of its other aims, wanted to evaluate the ABCDEF criteria that were proposed by Levitt et al. In 2000. A standing for age, also representing some populations that might be overrepresented with acral melanomas in general, including African American, Asian, and Native American patients. This study excluded race because of the location of the study and the lack of general heterogeneity of the population studied. Breadth is B, breadth of 3 millimeters or greater, brown to black color, variegated borders. In this study, they only evaluated for breadth, color, and borders were excluded. Change, of course, that's one of the parameters that kind of stays consistent between the ABCDEFs on acral sites versus those on more traditional sites. digit involved, with the thumb being the most likely location for a malignant lesion of the nail, followed by the hallux, the index finger, and then single digit more than multiple digits, extension of pigment onto the paronychia, such as Hutchinson's sign, and then family history of melanoma or dysplastic nevi. So they utilized those ABCDF criteria. They also evaluated for other worrisome features on dermoscopy, including non-homogeneous pigmentation, triangular shape of the band, nails plate splitting, and blurred lateral borders. Other worrisome dermoscopic findings that were recorded was if the lesion had irregular lines or loss of parallelism, where nevus should have brown or background with regular brown lines, or a melanotic macule should have regular gray lines. Those irregular lines or loss of parallelism would be more worrisome for a subungual melanoma. So as I said,
So these ABCDEF rules are not the same as the ABCDE rules we learn about for melanoma elsewhere.
Yeah, these are specific. Yeah, specific for the evaluation of longitudinal melanonychia.
Proposed in 2000. I don't remember learning them in residency. And spoiler alert, after reading this article, maybe it's just as well I didn't.
That's a pretty good spoiler alert. No one's going to beat you up for those spoilers, though, so you're okay. Right. It's not like Avengers Endgame.
Yeah, we won't talk about that. Or Game of Thrones. Off the table.
Not something we're going to discuss. So in this single center retrospective cohort study, they had 84 patients who had had a nail matrix biopsy. So we do have histologic confirmation and correlation with the findings they evaluated. They had 76 benign lesions, the majority of which were melanotic macules, some nevi, and some non-melanocytic lesions, and then
exactly
8 subungual melanomas.
Sorry, what exactly is a melanotic macule?
A melanotic macule is basically melanocytic hyperactivation in the nail matrix. So it's sort of equivalent to an ephelid on the skin. So hyperactivation of the melanocytes, they're overproducing pigment, but there is not an increased proliferation of them. So no increase in the number of melanocytes, just more pigment production.
I had never heard it called a melanotic macule. I've just heard like melanocyte activation. But okay.
Yes. Those are pretty much equivalent terms. And so they analyzed clinical images along with the dermoscopic images when available of the lesions that were included in the study. Unfortunately, only 5 of the 8 subungual melanomas were available for dermoscopic evaluation, and 20 of the benign lesions out of 76 were available for dermoscopic information. They also analyzed the age, sex, digit of presentation, time to presentation, whether or not there'd been change in the band, any associated symptoms, the width of the band, periungual presentation, family history, a history of trauma, or other involved nails. And they wanted to determine if any of these parameters were helpful to predict the likelihood that longitudinal melanonychia was present due to a malignant neoplasm. The finger involved, which is part of that ABCDEF criteria, found some interesting findings. In this study, the thumb was actually the most common site for all types of lesions, with 26% of all of the lesions in the study occurring on the thumb, 26% of the benign lesions also occurring on the thumb, and 25% of the melanomas. So the thumb is just a common location for single-digit longitudinal melanonychia. The hallux was the second most common, with 15% total, 17% of benign, and 25% of melanomas.
Something to do with trauma? Does your thumb get traumatized?
That is, I think, something to do with trauma. And interestingly, trauma has been put forward as potentially a etiologic agent versus an associated finding with subungual melanoma. They're not sure if it's causative or if it's correlative, and perhaps the lesions are more noticed because of other symptoms at that site with the lesion being present. But that was something that has been found in other studies and held in this particular study. Some other findings they found that were a little bit unexpected were that benign diagnosis patients, so those patients that didn't have a melanoma, were on average older than the patients where they found a subungual melanoma. They didn't identify this as a possible source of bias, but I personally know that when I have longitudinal melanonychia on an older patient, I'm likely to be a little bit more suspicious of it. So it's more likely I'm going to biopsy longitudinal melanonychia in an older patient than in a younger patient. So they may have accidentally had some bias incorporated into the study for that reason. Their younger patients that they did biopsy, I think that their clinical findings may have been more worrisome to push them to take that biopsy of a younger patient's nail. And so that potential source of bias was not addressed in the article, but that might have been a potential confounder. So their benign diagnosis patients were older, about 52 years of age, versus their subungual melanoma patients, about 36 years of age. The most important factors that they found in their analysis were band width greater than 3 millimeters, this parameter still missed one of the subungual melanomas. They had one pretty scary subungual melanoma that did not look that interesting, had a pretty narrow band without a whole lot of worrisome features to it. The bandwidth percentage was also found to be helpful. So this is the width percentage calculated by taking the width of the band of pigmentation on the nail and dividing it by the total width of the band. And so a bandwidth percentage of greater than 40% was thought to be a good cutoff point based off of an analysis that they performed that gave a sort of dichotomy between the benign and malignant lesions. They also found that the subungual melanomas often had been present longer, and about half of the patients with a subungual melanoma did report an increase in their bandwidth. They included all of the dermoscopic images of the subungual melanomas that they had, which was five of those, along with the 8 clinical images of all of the melanomas that they had in the subungual area, and a sampling of the dermoscopic images to represent the findings that they saw in the benign lesions. I think that, you know, some of the important things that came out of this were the more significantly the nail is kind of involved with the longitudinal melaninichia, the more worried you might be about the lesion. And the wider the width of the band might be, the more concerned you might be as well. The ABCDEF criteria that they analyzed actually didn't show statistical significance in any difference between the benign and malignant lesions. There was a slight trend towards having more positive criteria for the subungual melanomas than for the benign lesions, but that did not reach significance. So I think that the take-home messages from this article are that patients who are younger still need to be considered in your analysis for the possibility of subungual melanoma, although I do think that element of potential bias should be addressed. Bandwidth greater than 3 millimeters or a percentage of the nail involved greater than 40% should absolutely raise your concern. And some of the dermoscopic criteria that we have brought forward in previous studies, including loss of parallelism and potentially multiple colors, were not as predictive as one would hope. So I think that evaluating longitudinal melaninichia is a very important exercise in history taking, integrating patient symptom, how long the lesion has been present, presence or absence of trauma. Patient gender may play a role, as females were more predominant in this study as well as other studies for subungual melanoma, and potentially evolution of the lesion. So some interesting take-home points from that article.
Kind of a terrifying article.
A little bit.
Basically, our dermatoscopes don't help us much, and the clinical picture doesn't help us much. It's mostly just this bandwidth 40% or greater.
They did point out that there were some limitations to this study. It is a single center study. The population size is not huge. And so, of course, you know, as any good study does, it encourages further studies on the topic.
I think it's worth for our listeners to take a look at the pictures in here, especially of all of their subungual melanomas. I was showing these pictures to one of my residents yesterday, and I said, all right, here are, you know, 8 pictures of longitudinal melaninichia. Which ones do you think are melanoma? And he was like, this one, and this one, and this one I don't like. But, you know, they're all melanomas. So they look fairly benign, and especially terrifying is that
image
one
B.
They talked about, yeah, that's like 18% of the nail plate and the patient's like 60-something years old. It just doesn't meet any of the other rules that a lot of the other ones followed, like the wide band and the younger patients and all that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, with longitudinal melaninichia, there's definitely still at this point a little bit more art than science going on in that interpretation, but any information that we can get is helpful, and so I thought that there were some good points that came forward from the study.
Yes, I think the be extra suspicious if the nail band is 40% of the nail plate or greater is the primary take-home point.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
All right, so I'm going to review the next article. I've been looking forward to reviewing this one because it's already changed my practice to some degree. This is from the New England Journal of Medicine. Oh, I guess before we move on to that, this is still our demo episode, so we're trying to sort out exactly what to do, but probably worth mentioning some of the authorship. So the longitudinal melaninichia was by Dr. Lipner, was the senior author, and colleagues, Shari Lipner. And this next one is about treatment for actinic keratoses. So there's lots of different treatments for actinic keratoses, and it looks like finally somebody's done a trial comparing them directly. So The title is Randomized Trial of Four Treatment Approaches for Actinic Keratosis. It's by a large group of people from Norway. No, the Netherlands. Sorry. All European countries that start with N are not the same. But the senior author on this one is Clara Mostard. So they compared photodynamic therapy, inguinal mebutate, imiquimod, and 5-fluorouracil. And the upshot is that the 5-fluorouracil was superior. But going into the details, we might have an idea why. I have this thought that the odds may have been stacked in the favor of 5-FU. We'll get into that. So they had 624 patients, and their primary endpoint was being at least 75% clear of actinic keratoses at 1 year after treatment, which is pretty good. And then the 5-FU patients, 74.7% of them had achieved that endpoint. So about 75% were 75% clear of actinic keratoses at 12 months after the treatment. That's pretty significantly better than the others. So imiquimod was 54%, PDT was 38%, and inguinal was 30%, so a lot less. They built into their protocol rules for if the first treatment seemed to not work well. So if they performed a treatment, they had the patients come back at 3 months, and they said, well, if this wasn't a very good treatment, so less than 70% improvement, then we got another treatment. So there was this double treatment kind of built in. Though for imiquimod, they had patients come back 1 month afterward and would retreat them if they hadn't got 75% or better. These were, as you might guess, mostly white people. They're actinic keratoses. They're in the Netherlands. older-ish. And you have to go to their appendix online to get some of their specific protocols. But I think exactly what they did is important, because I think this might be one reason why 5-FU performed so much better than the others. So the main issue here is that they used the 5-FU twice a day for 4 weeks, which is a long time. Mm-hmm. So when I suggest that patients use it on their face, they do it for, 2 weeks, maybe three if they're lucky.
Yeah.
4 weeks is a long time. They also did superficial curettage in every lesion in this study, which I understand is sort of a standard practice in Europe, but I don't do that with my patients, and I'm pretty sure most American dermatologists don't seem to do that, so I don't know if that may have skewed the results for what we do. Their PDT protocol was with methyl aminolevulonic acid, MAL. We normally use ALA in this country, but they incubated it for 3 hours, so that's pretty good. And I looked up a few studies that said the effects of MAL were approximately comparable to ALA, so I think that's pretty good for their PDT. Inguinal, they had patients apply daily for 3 days. And imiquimod, they used the 5% solution, and the patients put it on Monday, Wednesday, Friday for 4 weeks. Which seems a little bit short, potentially. The manufacturer says BID for 16 weeks, which is significantly more than this protocol. Mm-hmm. So they did point out that there were no unexpected adverse effects. So presumably there was a bunch of skin irritation, which is expected. Nobody discontinued the trial for adverse effects. And the people who used the 5-FU were more likely to say, that wasn't too bad, and to have a retreatment, or say they would use it again, or say they would recommend it to a friend or a colleague who needed the same sort of treatment. Which surprises me, because in my experience, 5-FU is really darn irritating to the skin.
Yeah.
And so it's changed my practice to some degree. So in the past, I've mostly recommended either 5-FU or PDT for field therapy. I'm just not a huge fan of imiquimod or inguinal for other reasons. And I usually don't come down strongly on one or the other. But after reading this article, I think, there's something to be said for using 5-FU. But now I tell patients, if you can handle it twice a day for 4 weeks, we know that that gives you the best results.
Thinking about this article, I do wonder if the new codes for the application of PDT in the office might change current practice in the United States, because The code used to be the same whether or not you performed any superficial curettage on the actinic keratosis before applying the aminolevulinic acid, but now there are separate distinct codes that pay differently whether or not the patient has had curettage to the lesions prior to the application of the ALA and whether the physician or the nurse applies it. And so I think we may see some trends in change towards a more similar practice to that undertaken in Europe where the lesions are more frequently curetted before the application of the sensitizing agent.
Pros and cons, I suppose. I should point out that all of these AKs were in the head and neck area. So this wasn't like PDT or FUDEX for 4 weeks twice a day on the forearms, which is sort of common practice for me. This is like stuff on the face. A long time to have irritating face stuff. So maybe the Netherlandese are just a real tough group of people and they don't complain about stuff.
They're used to the frozen tundra. There's just not as much.
There you go.
Or maybe there's less sun damage.
A few other things they point out is that based on all of this, 5-FU also is the most cost-effective way to treat them. So a lot of good for 5-FU coming out of that study.
I agree. All right, ready for our next one? Okay, so the next journal that we're going to review is, are there distinct clinical and pathological features distinguishing idiopathic from drug-induced subacute cutaneous lupus erythematosus? A European retrospective multicenter study, which kind of says it all about how they designed this. I like it when they ask a question in the title. I think it's especially nice if it's answered. So this is an article from the JAD that was accepted earlier this year, so 2019. And it's, I think, a very well done study where they did a retrospective analysis of patients at 11 different European University dermatology units that had diagnosed cases of either drug-induced subacute cutaneous lupus erythematosus or idiopathic subacute cutaneous lupus erythematosus. So they gathered 232 patients, about 29% of which had drug-induced subacute cutaneous lupus and compared features in both their clinical presentation as well as their serologies and their histopathology. The differences that they found between the two groups were that the patients with drug-induced subacute cutaneous lupus were more likely to be older and to complain of more systemic symptoms. As soon as I read that, I started to think, is that because these patients are on more medications? Because the older patients get, the more patients tend to accumulate medications that they're taking for their other potential conditions, such as hypertension or cardiovascular disease. And to their credit, they did point this out, that polypharmacy is more common as patients get older, and that the most common drugs are those more commonly used in the aging population that can include antihypertensives and diuretics. The other clinical complaints of symptoms were more frequent in patients with drug-induced lupus, but when they were able to kind of differentiate them out by actual symptoms, there wasn't a specific symptom that was more correlative with drug-induced versus idiopathic SCLE. When they went ahead and looked at the serologies, they didn't actually find any significant difference between drug-induced and idiopathic SCLE. So I know the right answer on the test has always been antihistone antibodies being associated with drug-induced SCLE, but in this study, patients with iatrogenic SCLE were just as likely to have antihistone antibodies as patients with drug-induced SCLE.
So that means in 20 years, the tests will finally change to not have that.
They may eventually accommodate that finding, although for right now, it's still probably the right answer on the test.
Yeah, residents, histone.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Remember that? No, forget it. Okay. So the other serologies that were more commonly evaluated included, of course, ANA and anti-Rho antibodies, which they didn't really find a significant difference between the two groups. On histopathology, they did find a few features that were more likely to predict that the patient had iatrogenic SCLE, idiopathic SCLE versus drug-induced. So patients that more likely had organic disease not related to a medication were more likely to present with mucin deposition in the tissue, along with direct immunofluorescence positivity for granular IgM and C3 at the basement membrane zone, and the presence of leukocytoclastic vasculitis. So the histopathologist may be able to help out the clinician in differentiating between drug-induced or idiopathic subcutaneous lupus erythematosus by focusing on the presence or absence of mucin, the presence or absence of leukocytoclastic vasculitis, and if so provided, the direct immunofluorescence findings. So DIF may be more important when you're needing to differentiate between potential drug-induced versus idiopathic SCLE. They have a nice...
Mucin. The DIF findings were more common in idiopathic, and the leukocytoclastic vasculitis more common in drug-induced.
Yes, that's correct. And the leukocytoclastic vasculitis was more common in drug-induced. So the two kind of more immunologic predispositions, in my personal opinion, as a dermatopathologist, so that mucin production, I think, is sort of irritated fibroblasts being stimulated by the autoimmunity producing extra mucin, sort of like a oyster producing a pearl, and then the immunofluorescence indicating true presence of autoantigen and autoantibody, and then the leukocytoclastic vasculitis being more common with drug-induced SCLE may have something to do with antigenic modification due to the drug's presence in circulating vasculature. So I wonder about that. So I thought that was pretty cool. They did have a nice discussion about what drug-induced lupus is and how it's hypothesized to occur, as well as the criteria that are used to evaluate whether or not it's likely that a medication has caused SCLE. And so they use four questions with yes or no answers to try to determine if it's an unrelated or related adverse event. One is the plausibility of the time relationship between drug exposure and the manifestation's onset. Second question is the exclusion of an alternative explanation for the events. Third is evaluation of response of the interruption of the treatment, so sort of a D challenge. And then the fourth one, which is usually not done for ethical and practical reasons, which is reintroduction or rechallenge with the suspected drug. So most of the cases that they evaluated were more, probable drug-induced than, confirmed drug-related because of the lack of rechallenge.
Which the four criteria are called the Jones algorithm.
The Jones algorithm, which I thought was nice to know the name of that. That's a good pimping question for residents. I thought that was nice. One other parameter they did bring forward was how the eruption presented in the patients. So patients that had a more atypical presentation would be more likely in drug-induced SCLE versus patients that had a classical SCLE presentation. So that typical annular polycyclic or papillosquamous lesion would be more typical in patient with idiopathic SCLE, whereas patients who might have annular with a malar rash or annular rash with bullae, annular rash with erythema multiforme, or epidermal necrosis would be more frequently seen in the drug-induced group. So I thought that was a nice feature to bring forward as well. If the rash is a little bit less typical than what you would expect, then you might be a little bit more suspicious that that patient is presenting with a drug-induced version of SCLE. And there was some discussion that it's possible that drug-induced SCLE is underreported, and that you should remain vigilant for that as a potential cause, especially in patients on suspect medications. They made a nice list of those medications that had high frequency, and they're not going to be any surprise which ones were more commonly seen in their study. They're the kind of heavy hitters in this group: hydrochlorothiazide, terbinafine, biologics, TNF-alpha inhibitors, and certain NSAIDs and antihypertensive medications. Leflunomide came forward as sort of a winner for causing drug-induced lupus, which I thought was interesting.
Congratulations, leflunomide.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, woohoo, which is kind of a surprise because it is an immunomodulating agent, but not so much so because it affects TNF-alpha, and we know that the TNF-alpha inhibitors sometimes produce unusual reactions in patients, and we're also usually treating patients who are already immunologically twitchy, so it may be sort of a selection bias in that particular circumstance. But I thought it was interesting that they had four cases of patients in this relatively small sample set that were drug-induced SCLE related to leflunomide, and they were only able to find three previous cases reported in the literature. So that's kind of an interesting thing to bring forward. IVIG was also identified as a potential causative agent. So I think some nice features to help you potentially differentiate between drug-induced and idiopathic SCLE, and potentially offer some treatment options to patients. There's a good discussion also of unmasking of LE that can happen sometimes in patients, and That's the circumstance where a medication was started. The patient developed SCLE symptoms. The medication's withdrawn, but the symptoms persist. So they feel under those circumstances that the drug was more the triggering agent for a autoimmune reaction that will now persist in the patient.
I also noticed that some of the most causative agents include estroprogestinics.
Yeah, they had some fun words stuff. In there. Yeah, I thought that was interesting too.
Maybe it can make some sense because it's young women who get lupus, so I can kind of put that together in my head. And they also said this Jones algorithm revealed 4 drugs with a, quote, certain association with drug-induced lupus. Carboplatin, gemcitabine, well, in my head, chemotherapeutic agents can basically do anything. Yes. Lamotrigine, okay, I consider that kind of a dirty drug from a dermatologic standpoint. And then also desloratadine. So that one I thought was surprising, like this fairly common over-the-counter antihistamine, certain association with drug-induced lupus.
That was pretty surprising to me also. I was a little bit shocked by that one.
There you go. So I guess my take home is suspect drug-induced SCLE when I see someone with SCLE because it looks like 20% of SCLE is drug-induced. And then biopsy can be real helpful, especially with DIF.
Mm-hmm.
And then look for these. Go ahead.
I was going to say, let your dermatopathologist know that you kind of need their help in differentiating between the two.
Good old dermatopathologists, how we love them.
Aww.
So I'm going to talk about this interesting sort of educational med-ed kind of article, also from the JAD. This is called Optimizing the Total Body Skin Exam, an Observational Cohort Study. So the senior author on this was Jeffrey Miller. This is mostly out of Penn State Hershey. So when I was a medical student interested in dermatology and just learning physical exam stuff, they taught you, you know, how to listen to the heart and so on, but they didn't really go into too much detail about the exact method for looking at somebody's skin. And then when I was a dermatology resident, they still didn't really go into an exact protocol for how to look at somebody's skin. Like, do I look at the head first? Do I look at the legs first? Oftentimes the answer I got was, well, you develop your own style. And as long as you're sort of consistent and stick with your own style that you like, then you'll probably be fine. And then they would say something like, for example, I like to start with the head and go down. Or they say, I like to do the arms first and then the trunk or whatever. And that's been fine for me. And I have indeed developed my own style that I think works fine. But what these authors did is basically use science to try to figure out the best way to look at somebody's skin. So they had 5 attending dermatologists and 5 dermatology residents, and they performed a total body skin exam on a male standardized patient and a female standardized patient. Both the standardized patients were wearing undergarments and then a hospital gown. And they videotaped all of the exams, and then they used this technique called an analytic hierarchy process to then figure out the best way to examine somebody's skin. And by the best way, they mostly mean the most efficient way. So this analytic hierarchy process, I looked it up on Wikipedia, standard site to discover all things medical. And it looks like it's a way to assign weight to various factors, and then you compare each factor to a single other factor and decide which is most important, and you sort of keep doing that, and then everything ends up being weighted, and then you fall out with some kind of decision tree. So as I said, they used science to figure this out. So what they discovered was that in your average sort of non-protocolized skin exam where everybody's just doing their own thing, 1/4 to 1/3 of your time examining the patient is wasted. And by wasted, they mean you're moving around in a way that is less efficient than it would be if your goal was to sort of maximize the time you spend looking at somebody's skin and do it all as efficiently as possible. They also noticed that the most often missed body parts were the neck, that was missed about 1/4 of the time, and then the underarm area, as they called it. So I think that's probably like axilla and then like posterior proximal arm. And I remember you once telling me that that's a neglected spot on people's body.
I'm so proud.
Yeah, you're validated. And that was missed about 14% of the time as well. And then they come up with what using the videos and their analytic hierarchy process, and they mentioned, quote, their engineers, came up with what they think is
one of the most efficient ways to perform a total body skin exam, which is begin with the patient sitting, then look at their face, scalp, neck, don't forget the neck, chest, flank, stomach, arms, hands, and then legs and feet. The patient then stands, turns away from you, and then you look at the posterior scalp, the neck, the back, posterior arms, and then up one leg across the buttocks and down the other, and then you're done. And there's a nice little picture of this sort of idealized physical exam at the end of this article as well. And I think this is kind of cool. I'm not sure that it's going to change how I'm doing things because I'm an old dog, you know, even though I've not even been attending for a year. But still, that's old in dog years. So I'm set in my ways and I kind of know what I'm doing. So I think mostly what I'm going to do is remember to look at people's necks. But I do think that this is kind of a nice way to, for people who are just learning dermatology, trainees and so on, to say to them something like, well, you know, we all kind of do our own thing and that mostly works out all right. But if you're interested, there's been a study that shows that this is an especially efficient way to examine somebody's skin.
Yeah, it's very interesting. When do you look at the bottoms of the feet?
When they're sitting down, I look down one leg, and then I lift them up, and then I take a look.
Okay, so that's on the front part of the exam.
Yes. That no, that's sense. What I do. I think that's what they recommend, too, I think, and sort of goes along.
Okay, cool. I can definitely see the going up one leg and down the back of the other. And I've actually found as I've matured in practice that having the patient stand to look at their back is a lot easier than trying to do it with them on the bed, because some patients can't lie prone. And most patients can stand for at least a period of time so that you can perform that evaluation. You do have to have some flexibility in your knees, though, I think, to do the exam the way they've described, which, you know, fortunately is still something that's very easy for me to do, but I think that having the patient lie prone might be a valid option for people with mobility issues.
Makes sense. You could also get like a platform that raises up and they can the platform and then raise up to the level of your eyes. You could like look right at their calves.
What you really need is a laboratory like in Young Frankenstein, the movie. That's what you really, really need.
We all need that.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. All right, well, speaking of weird science, I would like to now sing for you something to conjure the image of what I'm about to go over, which is da-da-da-da-da. If you don't recognize that, that's the theme from Terminator, because this article's a little scary. Even the title's a little scary. So this is an article from the British Journal of Dermatology. It has got the senior author, Dr. Fujimoto, and the first author is Dr. Fujisawa. So you might be able to tell that this study was done in Japan. And this is a deep learning-based computer-aided classifier developed with a small data set of clinical images surpasses board-certified dermatologists in skin tumor diagnosis. There is an asterisk at the end of the title, which I think that they kind of clarify a little bit at the end, which is basically that, you know, it's a summary that's available online. So this is a study that applies deep learning technology to skin cancer classification. This is not a new endeavor. Deep learning technology has been used previously to help improve the sensitivity and specificity of skin cancer screening based off of visual images. But typically the training image set required for that has been extremely large, in the hundreds of thousands. And so in this study, they used a deep convolutional neural network, which is a kind of artificial intelligence neural network that's used to classify images and cluster them by similarity. So it learns the more that it sees. And they used an image set of 4,867 clinical images that had been obtained from around 2,000 patients that had been diagnosed with skin tumors in a single university hospital from 2003 to 2016. They separated them into diagnoses, a first step, which was benign or malignant, and then a second step, which was its specific type of diagnosis with the 14 different subheadings. And the classification accuracy of the trained deep convolutional neural network was 76.5%. There was 96.3% sensitivity in classifying an image correctly as either malignant or benign. There is, I believe, a typo actually in the article, because it says correctly classified. No, I'm sorry, that's not right. It says correctly classified malignant as malignant, sorry. So 96.3% sensitivity, and then 89.5% specificity, where it was able to classify benign lesions as benign. the accuracy of malignant or benign classification by board-certified dermatologists and dermatology trainees was also measured. As board-certified dermatologists, we should feel happy that our accuracy was greater than that of our trainees, but woo! A little bit, yeah, woohoo, here, outlasting the residents there, but...
System works.
The board-certified dermatologists actually had an accuracy of malignant or benign of 85.3% and 74.4% for the trainees. So that was a little disappointing that the board-certified dermatologists were not able to best this computer network study.
Break it down for me again. Computer was 90-something?
It was 96.3 sensitivity, which meant when you had a malignant lesion shown to this deep convolutional neural network, it correctly identified that lesion as malignant.
Probably so it's sensitive. Most important, right?
And that's an important parameter. So
96.
96.3.
And board-certified dermatologists were what?
85.3.
And then trainees were 70s?
74.4. So it was, it was close, but, there was a clear winner, which was a little disappointing. But there are some potential good uses for this technology that the article points out, possibly allowing it to be utilized for screening purposes in general medical practice. So it doesn't appear at this time that the goal of this software is to replace dermatologists. But, of course, that's the fear that it strikes in the heart of any of us when we're told we're inferior to a machine. So they did kind of have some very nice discussion of why diagnosing skin cancer accurately is so important. It is the most commonly diagnosed cancer in America. It's interesting that this study is based in Japan, published in the British Journal of Dermatology, but they use statistics from America. I thought that
was very international.
Yeah, very international. And of course, melanoma being responsible for the majority of skin cancer-related deaths. They go through kind of an interesting discussion of historical attempts to classify skin cancers with artificial intelligence and show the relatively disturbing pace with which technology improves itself given free rein. So what really happened with this DCCN software is that they unleashed the software from the parameters that were being set by humans. In previous use of artificial intelligence, the human programmers would provide parameters that they thought would be important for the instrument to collect data on, so such as color, uniformity, texture, things like that. In this particular instrument, they actually allowed the DCCN sort of free rein to learn as it was going and for it to basically utilize its algorithms to decide which features it thought were more important, and it became more efficient than what programmers had been able to achieve previously. So in a previous study that was a little bit more directed by humans, the data set was 129,450 that had been used to train this, and the accuracy of that particular endeavor didn't really reach any levels anywhere near this current exercise. So I thought that that was very interesting.
And they only needed 4,800 in this one compared
to 100,000. Yeah, they only needed 4,800. So it was a much more accessible size of the image set. Also, no dermoscopic images were included for this DCCN to do its learning protocol. They used the majority of the images for the learning set, and then they sort of squared off a percentage of them to be used in the analysis to basically test the DCCN against the board-certified dermatologists and the dermatology trainees. And they also did something very interesting to increase the number of images that the computer had to learn from, which was they rotated the images 15-degree increments to basically expand the training set. So this was basically a different image for the computer to interpret. As a human eye, you can rotate an image and we'll automatically recognize it as something we've seen before, but computer neural networks seem to work a little bit differently in that respect. They also altered the brightness between negative 10% and positive 10% to allow for variations in photography. And they also varied the blur filter for the photographs to kind of adjust for different quality of photographs that the DCCN might encounter. And so they wanted to evaluate different parameters of efficacy for this particular algorithm. First of all, they wanted to figure out if it could determine if lesions were benign or malignant, which is one of the most important steps, of course. Then they also wanted to see if it could accurately classify lesions into different diagnostic categories. That could include malignant epithelial tumors, melanoma, benign epithelial lesions, and benign melanocytic lesions. The DCCN was better at certain types of lesions than it was at others. So it was very good at diagnosing malignant epithelial tumors, very accurately diagnosed with an accuracy of 95.7%. So if you presented the software with a vision, with an image of a choroacanthoma or a squamous cell carcinoma or a basal cell carcinoma, 95.7% of the time it could figure out that it was a malignant epithelial neoplasm. Benign melanocytic conditions were very accurately diagnosed as well, with an accuracy of 90.9%. It was a little bit less good at diagnosing benign epithelial lesions, with an accuracy of 62.8%, and of accurately diagnosing melanoma, it was about 73%.
Now, so were the dermatologists better than the machine at any of these categories?
So that's actually not very well delineated. The percentage of accuracy with the dermatologists accurate, like evaluating them, that data is not presented in the same level of detail as it is for the computer network. There are some supporting information tumors. There's some supporting information tables that I am delinquent in downloading. So that is possibly available for view in a different portion of the publication that's available online. So I thought that that was interesting. I think important thing, of course, is that the melanomas that were not classified as melanomas were still identified as a malignant neoplasm, and still would, by that qualification, hopefully undergo appropriate biopsy. And I think
with a smartphone app attachment that, after it diagnoses you, can actually perform the biopsy, package it, and then send it by drone to the Amazon like pathology laboratory.
We're going to arm our smartphones with scalpels soon. It's going to be awesome. This isn't going to end badly at all.
Okay. What do you think about all of this stuff, Michelle?
I think it's very interesting. I think that there's a lot of potential in computer learning to help us kind of expand the tool set that we have to offer our patients. I think that this could hopefully expand access to screening services for patients in remote areas that maybe don't have access to a dermatologist. They did, and to their credit, discuss that the board-certified dermatologist evaluating the images may have been able to reach a more precise diagnosis in the other ways that we're trained, because we're not machines, and we're trained to evaluate the person in front of us, their history, their family history, the lesion in three dimensions, not in just a single image. And, that is a little bit more nuanced than just a, yes or no answer on a single photograph. But I do think that a lot of this is going to be how it's utilized and implemented. And this is an area that I think our voice is very much needed in as dermatologists, because this storm of technology is coming whether we like it or not. There are computer models all over the world being used to do all sorts of things. They're being used to beat people at computer games and beat people at chess and predict markets and analyze, parameters for different kinds of trends and fashion. There are even some very funny examples so far of deep learning computer networks trying to write things. So they give them, certain assignments to read. There's a very funny one where they had them read all the Harry Potter books and then try to write something in that style. And I mean, right now they're not very intelligible, but these things learn quickly. And as you can see, the technology, even just from, 2011 to our present day, their data set and their accuracy, the requirements for images input to the system has decreased dramatically, and the accuracy of these systems has increased kind of wildly. So this technology isn't going away, but our voice can be instrumental in guiding how it's implemented. And I think that the more we know about it and the more we're present in discussions about how it's used and which parameters it are put into place to ensure that first and foremost our patients' safety and privacy is protected, are the things that we need to use our voice for in this discussion. So while it's easy to get disheartened reading an article that says that, you know, this computer-aided classifier surpasses board-certified dermatologists, and as, you know, a person who always wanted to get, you know, the best scores on a test or something, that hurts my heart. But, you know, this is the world that we're presented with today, and it's changing, and the landscape is a sort of a brave new world, and we need to move forward into the future with this technology, or it will surpass us, for real.
Yeah, I consider myself kind of a technological optimist for the most part. And it's easy to feel threatened by something like this, but if I was a member of the general public, which I am in many spheres of my life, and I was told, well, there's two different ways you can get this skin lesion diagnosed, and one is better than the other, then I would pick the one that's better. I think if it were, you know, a computer or a cool-looking robot, it might turn me off a little bit compared to if it was another human. But, like, we have all kinds of tests in medicine. For example, did primary care doctors feel threatened with when a good test for diabetes came out? Did anybody say, wait a sec, I'm the one who's supposed to be diagnosing diabetes, not this lab test? I mean, I have no idea if they did or not, but you can sort of think of this kind of thing as the same kind of deal. So first of all, identifying an individual skin lesion is just one of our many skills as dermatologists. And I think that if there's technology out there that can help us do it and help create a healthier population, then we shouldn't feel too threatened by it. The idea is, as you said, to figure out the proper use for it. There was a talk at the AAD about some of this stuff where the speaker said the reason he was concerned is that he thinks that our workload is going to increase significantly when people have stuff like this in their phones. There's going to be more of them coming into the dermatologist saying, you know, my phone told me this lesion was scary. And then we'll also be confronted with a lot more like difficult to classify lesions, because presumably somebody's smartphone app will classify something as benign, don't worry about it, malignant, go get a biopsy, which we can do, or I'm not quite sure. And then they'll come see us and we'll be like, well, I don't know if I'm quite sure either. So it'll sort of challenge us a little bit more. And I just also wanted to point out conflict of interest. A number of the authors here are employed by Kyocera Communication Systems, which presumably is developing this for some kind of commercial purpose.
The funny thing is that when I was reading that, the name of that did remind me a little bit of certain names that are in the Terminator movies.
Oh, yeah? All I remember is Skynet and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
It was funny. But, you know, I think that it is something that's good for us to be informed about.
All right. One more article. Less scary. This is an article about surgical technique, and it's comparing 5-0 fast gut to 6-0 fast gut.
Okay.
So the senior author on this is Dr. Eisen, and this is out of the same group that also published an article that we reviewed in our last demo episode about suture spacing for head and neck surgery. And as we'll remember, because we all listened to that demo episode, it didn't matter if you use 2 millimeter or 5 millimeter suture spacing for surgical closures on the head and neck. So they basically did the same thing this time, but this time comparing 5-0 fast gut and 6-0 fast gut. So they had 50 patients. They're mostly white men in their 60s and 70s. They had dermatologic surgery on the head and neck. They are mostly attending dermatologists and Mohs surgeons who are doing it, but there were some fellows and residents as well. There was mostly Mohs surgical closures, but there were a few just standard excisions as well. They tried to standardize the surgical technique outside of this 5-0 versus 6-0 thing. So everybody got 5-0 Vicryl for deep sutures. If the suture wouldn't hold for some reason, they switched to 4-0. And then each particular wound served as its own control. So one half was closed with 5-0 and the other half was closed with 6-0. And the spacing of the sutures was tried to be 3 to 5 millimeters. And of course, just as before, they found that there was no difference in cosmetic outcome or in complications. So just like before, they used the same kind of grading system for scars, which is supposed to grade a scar on various measures of cosmetic appearance as well as symptomatology. And it's called the POSAS, POSAS, I guess, Patient and Observer Scar Assessment Scale. And they all did pretty well, and there was no difference. So their conclusion was, use 5-0 or 6-0, whatever you want. I like studies like this because I feel like they challenge some of our received wisdom. Like, there's a lot of stuff in dermatology and in medicine in general that you just kind of do because you were taught it and somebody was like, you know, 6-0 gives you a better closure in this part of the face. But, like, how does that person know? Maybe they just sort of think it makes sense, or maybe their mentors told them when they were in training. So it always makes me wonder what other received wisdom we know is wrong. Like, maybe we can use 4-0 gut on people's faces instead of 5-0, and it'll be easier to handle or cheaper or in some other way superior. So there you go. 5-0 versus 6-0 gut, use whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's a nice, you know, thing to take home, because, you know, sometimes I think you're right that we just do things because they're dogma or because that's what the conventional wisdom is. And it's always good to question dogma, because sometimes we're doing things because that's the way we've always done them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's the best or most correct way to do it. And I think that it's always nice when you can find out that sometimes the less complicated or less expensive way of doing something is just as good as the preferred, more complicated method.
Yeah, so is the deep learning network going to be the cheaper way to do things?
I don't know. That's an interesting
question. Sorry to bring everybody's epinephrine levels back up.
I'll tell you, like, so far a lot of that technology hasn't proved to be very cost effective because of the way it's been implemented. So, you know, an example of that would be some of the dermoscopic image analysis instruments that charge a certain fee per image to be interpreted. So the cost of that can be somewhat prohibitive for its use in the most needed circumstance, which would be in the sort of primary care doctor's office where the patient doesn't have access to a dermatologist. And it'll be interesting to see if and when this technology is rolled out, how it's meant to be implemented. Would it be an iPhone app that, you know, charges per image interpretation? Would it be some kind of free thing where you watch an ad to pay for it? Like, you know, here's an ad for Candy Crush. Now I'll look at your mole. It'd be very interesting. We're all going to get paid in retweets. But hopefully it will be utilized in a way that improves patient access and maintains patient safety and quality of care.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. I kind of wish I could time travel forward 20 or 30 years and just sort of take a look at what's going on and if it's going to be significantly different than what's happening now or not so much. Mm-hmm. All right. So just to recap today, we learned about longitudinal melanonychia and that it's terrifying, and a band of 3 millimeters or greater, or of 40% of the nail plate or greater, should especially raise your antenna. 5-fluorouracil, 5%, performed better than all of its alternatives to treat AKs on the face when it was used BID for 4 weeks. We talked about drug-induced versus idiopathic SCLE and how biopsies are especially helpful. The idiopathic tends to have more mucin and more, remind me.
It has the immunofluorescence pattern of granular C3 and IgM, and the drug-induced variety has more leukocytoclastic vasculitis. And I don't know if this is the mechanism, but conceptually I thought about the fact that the drug is circulating through the vascular spaces and potentially has more ability to modify the vascular endothelial cells, creating a target for antigenic stimulation. That might not be the method, but if it helps you remember it, then that works.
Sounds good enough. I believe that's the method now. We also talked about using science to optimize the total body skin exam. We talked about how computers are better than us, but we don't quite know how that technology is going to play out. And probably the most important take-home point is that we've got to be there for the discussion about how to use it rather than just sort of fight against it. And then 6-0 and 5-0 gut equivalent for closures on the head and neck. So that's our show for today. I want to thank the University of Utah Department of Dermatology for sponsoring us and for just generally being an awesome place to work. Shell, anything you'd like to say at the end?
No, thank you for the opportunity to be a part of this. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Friends who have been listening to the demo episodes, hopefully this will be the last one, though we'll have to take a listen, of course, and decide. And we can maybe get rolling with real episodes next time. Look forward to that.
Awesome sauce.